So it's so nice to be here and to see so many devotees congregated together again here at New Nandagram. It's a great pleasure. When I was asked to prepare something for this particular retreat, I was in the midst, like most of you, majority of you, in the midst of all the varying things that go on in a household life, all the headaches, all the distractions, all the responsibilities and so forth, that keep you kind of like up to your neck and over your head thinking about what's next on the practical plane. And so I didn't feel very much confidence that I could get something together for this retreat because of so many things around me that were taking my attention. But then I remembered from previous retreats that there is like a formula for somebody in my condition that I must follow, and that is, it's just like if you're going to have a yajna or if you're going to cook something. You get all the ingredients together. You bring all the ingredients and put them very carefully together. And then when the time comes to cook, somehow or another you put them on the fire and everyone says, oh, that was wonderful what you cooked and prepared. But you know that all that I did really was I tried to collect some ingredients. And then they actually took their own activity occurred by themselves. And this is a very powerful way which one can develop confidence alongside of humility based on one's actual capacity. Rather than overly confident or underly confident, you know what you have to do and you know who does the rest. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is like that. The Bhagavatam may sit on your shelf or on your bookshelf for years and years and years. And you may pick it up sometimes and you may get some enlightenment from it, or you may pick it up and find that the words remain simply like words on the page. But then at some point when you pick it up and Krishna is pleased with you, he will come straight to you through the Bhagavatam, as he will through the holy name, as he can through the holy dhams. He comes through the deity in this way. We cannot demand him to come, and that's what's frustrating for us, because we would like to be able to quantify everything and control everything by our own endeavors and get everything just where we want it. And modern society is intensifying this mood. The intensification is that efficiency is the most important principle. The more you can fit into life, the more successful you will be, the more that everything you always desired will come to pass, the more you have, the less you will want. This is the ethos of Kali Yuga. And factually speaking, we have all, I think, had some experience that it isn't like that. In reality, it isn't like that. And the older you get, the more you look back and say, it hasn't been like that for me. I have so much, or I don't have so much, but it hasn't extinguished all my material desires. And it hasn't made my heart peaceful and calm. It just means there's another responsibility and another responsibility. And now my children are grown up and they have children. And there's their children to worry about and my children to worry about. And what happens if there's a war? And on and on and on and on. So this is not only our plight. This is the nature of the material world. And there's a principle. And the principle is that the more you have, the more degraded you become. So we're going to begin talking about Narada Muni by speaking about this particular principle. So I chose Narada Muni as my topic because I was thinking it would give me a lot of easy subject matter. I could quickly get this together and I wouldn't have to put too much effort behind it. But as I started to read in the Bhagavatam, I started to discover that Narada Muni pops up everywhere. Everywhere. From the very beginning, factually speaking, it's only because of him that the Bhagavatam was compiled. He was the one who instructed you write down the glories of the Lord. So we'll hear about that. But he comes here, he comes there, he's everywhere. And he tells his life also, how he got to the position of elevated consciousness that he occupies. And he has a mission. His mission is the name Narada. What does this mean? Nara. Sometimes the word Nara can mean like a person. Like we say, Narottam, Narottam, topmost human being. So Da, the word Da, it comes from a verb and it means the giver. So he is the giver to men of instructions in devotion. And Nara can also be, we see in the Chaitanya Bhagavat that Lord Chaitanya kept calling out, he would call Advaita Acharya Nara all the time. Nara has called me, Nara brought me here. And we see that the spiritual master of Narada Muni is Nara Narayan. So Nara can also be a name that means the supreme. So he can be considered too, this name Narada can be translated as the giver of instructions to men, or he who can deliver the Lord. So through his instructions, he can deliver the Lord. This is his powerful position. So Srila Prabhupada very much embodied the mood of Narada Muni, and we'll also hear about this in one of our classes. Because he himself wanted to also be the giver of instructions that could deliver the Lord to men. He was empowered to do this. This was his heart's desire. And so he often would glorify Narada Muni in a mood just like you would glorify a hero. If there was somebody who was much more intelligent than you or much stronger than you, and you would say, he's my idol, I look up to him. So Srila Prabhupada would speak in this way. And also in numerous occasions he would emphasize that our disciplic line is a line from Narada Muni, because it begins with Brahma, and the son of Brahma is Narada, and then it proceeds down from there. So what does Srila Prabhupada say about Narada Muni? Many things, so many things. But in the third chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, now I know we have a lot of people here who've been studying the Bhagavatam, so you'll be well aware that in the first chapter of the Bhagavatam, the sages who were seeing the future, they had the ability to, like a premonition, just like maybe we know, we have the sages who see the future told us it would rain today. Right? They have some power, and so they could predict this. So these sages were not ordinary sages, and they were meeting together at Namasharanya, which is considered the hub of the universe, such a powerful, potent place. So they were meeting together there because they could see what Kali Yuga was about to bring in. Just like if somebody said, there's going to be this afternoon a cyclone, and it's going to blow all the roofs of all these houses, and it's going to cause so much havoc, and so on and so forth, we would all be very much worried, and we would perhaps be working out what we could do about that. If we couldn't avoid this dangerous situation, where would we place ourselves and our belongings to avoid the greatest amount of danger? So these sages saw like that in Kali Yuga, and they saw that when Kali Yuga comes, by the invisible hand of time, everything is going to degenerate, step by step by step. So any intelligent devotee knows that whatever is presented to us on any level by anyone in the material atmosphere as progress is never progressive. It's always the opposite. That's according to the spiritual standard. Materially, you may say this is progress, but spiritually, it will be the opposite. It will be a degradation. So this intelligence these sages had, and they wanted to know what they could do because they could see it. Just like if I could predict the future and told you there'll be an earthquake here, and I knew, and I would think, what can I do with it for these poor people? This terrible thing is about to occur. I would try to get you located somewhere else and tell other people, give them a warning. So the sages were thinking like that. What can we do to help the people who are going to face this Kali Yuga influence? And at that time, they chose Sutta Goswami to speak. And they asked him six questions. They asked him, what was the essence of all religion, of all scriptures? What is good for the people in general? Please tell us about Krishna when he appears as the son of Devaki. Please tell us about all of his incarnations when he appears in this form and that form and this form. We want to know about all of them. And please tell us about his Purusha incarnations in which he creates, maintains the worlds. We want to know how this material world came about. How am I here? What is it? Where did it come from? From the spiritual perspective, not from the academic, the educational perspective, some theory or another, there was a lump, there was something, and so on and so forth. No, I want to know, where did it all come from? So they were asking this, and finally they asked, where did religious principles go? Now that Kali Yuga is beginning, where can we find true religion? And the sages asked these questions earnestly, and then Sutta Goswami began to reply. So in the third chapter, he's speaking specifically about all the incarnations of the Lord. In other words, all the times that the Lord appears in this world for the benefit of those who are still engrossed in matter. He comes in this way and that way and so many different ways to release them from their confusion. I heard Srila Prabhupada say that the characteristics of the material world is a place where everybody is crazy and talks only nonsense. And when I read that, I read it, and I was so shocked when I read that, because, you know, you think there are some intelligent people in this world and some people are foolish. So I was like, where everyone is crazy and talks only nonsense. So this is how a transcendentalist views this world, just as a sane man views a mental institute, where everyone is crazy and talks only nonsense. They think they are somebody other than who they are. So this is the nature of the material world. So Narada, here is what Srila Prabhupada says about him. The great Rishi Narada, who is an empowered incarnation of the personality of Godhead, propagates devotional service all over the universe. All great devotees of the Lord, all over the universe. Now that's a lot, isn't it? All great devotees, all over the universe, and in different planets and species of life, are his disciples. Just imagine how significant he is. Everyone, practically, who is a devotee is considered his disciple. Vyasadeva, the compiler of the Srimad Bhagavatam, is also one of his disciples. Narada is the author of the Narada Pancharatra, which is the exposition of the Vedas, particularly for the devotional service of the Lord. This trains the fruitive workers to achieve liberation from the bondage of fruitive work. The conditioned souls are mostly attracted to fruitive work because they want to enjoy life by the sweat of their own brows. The whole universe is full of fruitive workers in all species of life. So if the whole universe is full of fruitive workers, we need to know what a fruitive worker is, because that incorporates also ourselves, because we're part and parcel of the whole. So a fruitive worker, sometimes these words, we hear them and hear them and hear them and hear them, and they become like a cliché. They just go in one ear, out the other. And when we talk to people, we use them like a computer language. But very simply stated, a fruitive worker is somebody who's doing something and is seeking the result of what he's doing for himself. Now just imagine, who amongst us could not put their hand up about being in that category? I'm doing something, I'm taking care of something, I'm working very hard, but I want some result from it. I'm expecting something to return to me as a result of my doing that activity. So this fruitiveness, this I want something for me out of what I'm doing now, is the essence of karma, because I have desire, I want this thing, so when I receive it, I think now I have it. Now I want this. Now I want that. A good example is the story that Srila Prabhupada used to tell about the potter who's sitting with his one clay pot and he's thinking to himself, this pot is probably worth about 10 rupees. So when I sell this 10 rupee pot, then I will get enough money to buy some more clay. And when I get that clay, I will make not one pot, I will make 5 pots. And those 5 pots with this 10 rupees worth of clay that I will get me 50 rupees. And then when I have 50 rupees, I will not make 5 clay pots, I will make 50 clay pots. And when I get my 50 clay pots, I will sell those. And when I sell those, I will get... And he was going on and on and on, thinking and thinking and thinking with his one clay pot in his hand. And he put his clay pot down. And as he was sweeping his hand across to describe to himself how many rupees he would have, he knocked over his pot. And he had nothing. So this is how we are. We have something, something, something. And from that I can get this. And from this I will get that. And this is how the mind works. And even of a good person, their mind works like this. So what do we do about this? This is considered to be a dilemma. But what do we do? This is the very basis of everything. This is our motivation. If we had no motivation, why would we do anything? So Narada will help us with this. The conditioned souls are mostly attracted by fruitive work because they want to enjoy life by the sweat of their own brows. The whole universe is full of fruitive workers in all species of life. The fruitive works include all kinds of economic development plans. But the law of nature provides that every action has its resultant reaction, and the performer of the work is bound up by such reactions, good or bad. The reaction of good work is comparative material prosperity, whereas the reaction of bad work is comparative material distress. But material conditions, either in so-called happiness or in so-called distress, are all ultimately meant for distress only. Foolish materialists have no information of how to obtain eternal happiness in the unconditional state. Sri Narada Muni informs these foolish fruitive workers how to realize the reality of happiness. So our class today is on the reality of happiness. Happiness that is beyond this risk of loss, or happiness that is beyond the feeling that you get it and then you're satiated. You don't want any more of that. Now I want something else. Just like Srila Prabhupada spoke of the travel bug that people have really capitalized on, and they have made the travel, what is it, travel industry, the tourist industry. It is a big thing in the world. Why do they want to travel and travel and travel? They're thinking we want to travel because we're so interested in the world. We want to see all the rest of the world. It's so exciting. But Srila Prabhupada, as a transcendentalist, viewing the same phenomena, says they want to travel because they're not satisfied. And as one thing is equal to another, you look at it from the other side and you realize, of course, if I was satisfied where I was, I wouldn't care about anything else. I'd think, oh yes, there's so many things, but I have such a wonderful situation. I'm so full of happiness that I actually have no need for that. And somebody would say to you, would you like this? No, it's okay. If you're full and somebody brings you some food, you say, no, it's okay. Even if it's something luxuriant to eat, you'll say, no, that's okay. So similarly, like this, this real happiness, the reality of happiness, means happiness that carries no insecurity with it, no risk of loss, and fullness completely satisfies the heart, and it won't end, and it's always changing, because the other side of the desire to see so many things is we like variety. So variety is part of that happiness. It's not something static, it's something dynamic. This is the reality of happiness. But we as fruitive workers, we're bound in our little cycles, of what we want to get, how we want to do it, how we're going to get this, and we don't look up and see this. He gives direction to the diseased men of the world, how one's present engagement can lead one to the path of spiritual emancipation. He's not saying give it all up. He's teaching how it can lead. This is the bhakti process. How you can use what you have now to get to this point. And this is no little asterisk at the bottom saying conditions apply. I'm sorry, you're going to fit into this. No, anyone. All species of life are his disciples. So the cause of the disease and the remedy of the disease may be the same, but it must be treated by an expert physician like Narada. The Bhagavad Gita also gives the same solution to serving the Lord by the fruits of one's labor, and that will lead one to the path of liberation. Now the first story I would like to share with you, because we want the mercy of Narada Muni, and to get his mercy, first we have to know who he is and why should we want his mercy. Why? If I say, we want the mercy of Mr. da-da-da-da-da-da, you think, who is he anyway? Why should I want his mercy? So we need to know, who is he? And in preparing for this retreat, I felt myself fortunate by collecting and reading so many things to understand for myself to a greater degree than I will be able to convey in my words, that Narada Muni is a very, very significant person to wish for his blessings. So one time Narada was going through the heavenly planets, because he can go anywhere. He's like the air. He can go anywhere. There's no restriction on his travel. And he plays his veena and chants Radhika Raman and goes anywhere he wants. But he cannot stay anywhere. So Narada, he was traveling through the heavenly planets and he came to the Nandanvan forest, the gardens there, and he saw there was one beautiful garden there, and in that garden were the two sons of Kuvera. And these two boys, young men, were very handsome, very strong, very wealthy, very attractive to women. And they were surrounded by many beautiful women. And there they were enjoying life in a very, very contemporary way. Practically speaking, they were naked and they were drinking these wonderful beverages and wine, and they were so intoxicated. And the young girls were naked, they were naked, and there they were all sporting together. And Narada came. And the young girls, who had some modesty and common sense, they became horrified. Oh my goodness. It's like if we were doing something very shocking and Srila Prabhupada walked in, we would all be shocked. They were terrified and they realized this is a sage. He could curse us for our indecent behavior. So they very quickly grabbed some of their cloth and covered themselves up in shyness and became very ashamed and embarrassed. But these two young men were so intoxicated and so indulgent that they didn't even realize what they were doing. And they were just standing there. Narada's standing there, and they're standing there, and Narada's looking at them. They're looking at him, as we see in the picture, with their glasses upraised in great delight. And Narada became angry with them. But his anger is not like our anger. It isn't coming from ignorance and passion. His anger is coming from the fact that it is his business to deliver. And here are these two boys, two young men, and he thought to himself immediately how to treat them, how to deal with their foolishness. Look at them. They're so intoxicated that they cannot even understand that they're standing in front of a sage naked. So he became very angry and he thought to himself what to do. So he thought through and he spoke to them and explained to them. He said to himself, I will relieve them of their false prestige because of drinking and pride. Look at them, they are so fallen that they do not know that they are living naked like trees. By my plan, they will remember their past sinful activities until they are released from the punishment that he was about to administer. And as a special favor, they will see the Lord after 100 years of the demigods and then revive their real position as devotees. So what he wanted to do was to stationarily set them as trees. Look at you, you're naked. Trees are also naked. You don't care about being naked. Trees don't mind being naked. So many trees are out here. They don't wear anything. So if you want to act like this, and he explained to them his principle. He said, you've become very wealthy. Here is the logic that he provided to them. He said, you have become wealthy. You're born in a wealthy family. Therefore, from that comes a kind of madness. And from that madness of having so much wealth and being intoxicated by that comes pride. And from that pride comes wine, women, and gambling. And from the wine, women, and gambling stage comes cruelty. And then from that cruelty comes the desire to kill and eat animals. And then you have to suffer by going to hell. So then the question can be asked, who does your body belong to? Does it belong to you? Do you have a right to do this? Does it belong to your mother and father? They say, this is my son, my daughter. Does it belong to society? You're an Australian, an Indian, you must follow the rules of the country. Who does it belong to? And he explained that it belongs to the worms who are going to eat it, or it belongs to the fire who is going to burn it to ashes when you've finished using it. It doesn't belong to you, you can't keep it. So then he says, therefore, a rich person has all of these difficulties. So then they should be returned to poverty. Now it's interesting that Narada should prescribe this, because Narada later we will hear him describing his own life. And he was also very handsome and attractive. And he was also surrounded by many young women. And he was having a good time as well. And he was also cursed to change his situation from one of wealth and opulence and beauty and so many things, and being a good musician. He was a great musician, and he had so many people, so many girls thought he was just wonderful. He was cursed from that, and he had to become poverty-stricken. This was his experience. And when he was poverty-stricken, he explains in his speaking to these boys, he says, you know, a poverty-stricken man can meet and be introduced to a sage, not a wealthy man. A spiritualist will go to the house of a poverty-stricken man because he'll be humble and he will welcome them because he has nothing much. But a man who has a house, he has a lot of money, he'll have a big fence around his house, quite naturally. He'll have a dog. He'll have a sign on the gate, beware of the dog, security is applied here. You know, he'll have all of his security systems so no thieves can come, but no saints can come either. Because he has accumulated all of this, and it's mine, it's mine, it's mine. So he wanted to take them back. He said, if you experience the pain of poverty, the pinching, it's like the pinching of needles in your body. Anyone who's had a little poverty in their lives knows what it's like. You don't have any leeway. When you have wealth, you can think, oh, I could do this, I could have that, I can have so many options. And if that wealth is removed, then you just have to do whatever you can do. You can't do more. And there's something very leveling about that also. There's something quite, on a certain level, if your desires go down, as your economic situation goes down, it's quite peaceful. If your desires stay up and your money goes down, then it's quite traumatic. But he was saying to them, he would put them in a situation that they would return to sense, they would become purified, then they would become free of passion because they have no money to spend, and then they would be able to see saintly persons properly. And factually speaking, he is in his benediction, he wanted them to see not only saintly persons, but he wanted them to see Krishna himself. So this is what he was thinking. Rich people are guarded, but poor people get a greater chance to serve and meet saintly people. So I will give you 100 years, which is a long time, but of course they were demigods, so it wasn't as long to them as it would feel to us. 100 years you can stand there and think about what you've done. As they call it sometimes, time out, right? In the corner. And he didn't take away their memory, because trees generally have no consciousness. So you break a branch of a tree, it hardly feels it because its consciousness is so restricted. But they were given their full consciousness to meditate all this time. And then he said, all right, so this is to take place. Now, Parikshit Maharaj, when he heard this, he thought, this sounds like a spirit of revenge. Okay, you're going to do this. I'm going to do this to you. So Maharaj Parikshit asked why Narada was subject to such a spirit of revenge. But it isn't tamasic, his cursing. It's not out of anger like sometimes there are old sages, you know, who were a little irritable, and somebody would do something they didn't like and they would immediately punish them. But this was not the case with Narada. He is like a good physician. From the spiritual platform, whatever he is trying to do for them is meant to lead everyone home. So he would end up giving them great benefit by this. So they stood, he returned to his ashram, he went on with his activities, and they stood there for a long time. And when Krishna very conveniently was tied by Mother Yasoda to the grinding mortar, and he looked at these trees, and he thought to himself, this is what Krishna was thinking, he said, although these two men, as he knew, these are the trees, are these two demigods, although they're very wealthy men, I have nothing to do with them. They didn't want him. They're busy drinking and sporting and having a good time, like after the football, and they're like this. And he didn't have anything to do with them. They didn't have anything to do with him. There's no connection between them. But Narada is my very dear and affectionate devotee. Therefore, because of his desire, I must meet them and deliver them. I must do this. So we should pick up, there's a very powerful theme here for us, something very relevant for us. Because it may be that sometimes if we look at ourselves very accurately and assess our condition, we'll feel that we don't really have very much devotion. And why would Krishna come and do something wonderful for us? Who are we after all? Much of the time our mind is absorbed in ourselves. We try sometimes to remember him, but it becomes very difficult in the midst of so many other considerations, family, social obligations, educational obligations, and then there's sickness, and then there's old age, and then there's death. So many things. Why is he going to be so specially attracted to me? Srila Prabhupada explains further. Nala Kuvera and Manigriva had nothing to do with devotional service or with seeing Krishna face to face. This was not an ordinary opportunity, and no material qualification of theirs would make it possible for them to see him like this. But because Narada desired it, Krishna wanted to please his devotee. If someone seeks the favor of a devotee instead of directly asking favors from the Lord, then one becomes very easily successful. So here is a principle. Most people in the world today, they don't seek the favor of the Lord's devotee. They pray to God for whatever they want. God, give me this day our daily bread. They go to the temple, please heal my family, please do this, please give me this, please give me good marks, a good wife, a good husband, so on and so forth. This is the average idea of religion. But here, Srila Prabhupada is giving us a hint to what we have, which is very fortunate, and that is that we have an opportunity to seek the favor of a devotee. Without the favor of a devotee, it is very hard to meet what to speak of to serve the Lord. So we again may have turned this around in our minds and think that there's so much service. It's like, it never ends. So many things I have to do. I don't feel that it's a great rarity to serve. I feel like my whole day is being taken up by demands and so forth. But this is when we have lost the consciousness of service and we're busy with activities. Then when activity isn't service, service is for somebody else. I was thinking about this recently. When I clean my room, it's not service. It's something I'm doing for myself. My room is messy, I clean it up. When I clean the temple, it's service. But still, it doesn't have to be service if when I'm doing it, I'm thinking, okay, I'll do this and then I can get that done and so many other things. It still carries the opportunity of being service. But the service is in the mood of serving, of giving something. And it's very difficult to maintain that. I think everybody would agree. My experience is very difficult to maintain that mood of service. And that's what it's saying here. Without the favor of a devotee, it is very hard to meet what to speak of serve the Lord. So the mentality is very hard to get. We think, I'm not doing it. Oh, I try a bit harder and I can do it. But the reality is it has to come to us. And this is a change of concept that is required in the process of bhakti. And with that change of concept, then one can begin to pray. Without that, one just gets frustrated and tries a little harder and feels good about oneself or bad about oneself. And one thinks that this is the process, but this is not. The gift is the mentality of wishing to serve Krishna, the mood. When they came out of this situation as trees, because Krishna pulled the grinding mortar, and sometimes it is said in Ananda Vrindavan Champu, Srila Kavi Kanpur describes that there was a huge loud sound, and the trees didn't fall immediately. But these two demigods, you know, just like on a very minor scale, you know, when you turn on the computer and it makes a whoosh noise. So this noise came, and there they were. And Mother Yasoda and everybody else didn't really know what was taking place. And then when the trees fell, and then the boys said, two men came out of these trees. They were like shining, you know, they had like light coming out of them. And they bowed down to little baby Krishna, who's like teeny tiny crawling. They bowed down to him and then they whooshed off up into the sky. Nobody believed them. They thought this is just children's talk. But when they came out of the trees, due to their continuing memory, which was the gift, their memory was a gift, they could understand the supremacy of Krishna by Narada's mercy. So then they offered many prayers. In the Bhagavatam, their prayers are there. But I've taken a few points from those prayers. And one is that they pointed out to Krishna, who is now playing like a little boy in front of them, looking like, why are you speaking to me? I'm just here, you know. And look, my mother's tied me up, and I can't even get this loose. And you're talking to me? Why me? You know, he was playing, very playful. They said that we should understand that we have been delivered by the blessings of Narada. But Narada's blessings, or the blessings of the devotee, are all your plan. So they take, you see there is a flow. It is like a dance, a rhythm. There is a rhythm between Krishna's mercy and his devotee's mercy. His devotee's mercy and Krishna's mercy. And without one, without both, we will not understand the beauty of the enactment of the pastimes. The devotee wants to take others and give them to Krishna. Krishna wants that. He wants us back, so he sends his devotee to deliver bhakti. Without bhakti, we will not have any interest in the Lord. We will just think something, some religion, something, no real depth will come in our heart. So they said, you are the supreme mystic, and therefore your plan is so nice, that we stayed here as twin Arjun trees and you have appeared to deliver us. This was all your arrangement. So Prabhupada, or the Bhagavatam, tells us that the more one advances in devotional activities, the more one can understand Krishna as he is. So if we find it difficult, and I know for myself, I would say like a barometer. If you can take a statement that says, you must do this and you will get this, then I always turn it into a relative statement by saying, the more you do this, the more you'll get of this. So that I can then gauge myself. If I'm getting any, no, okay, I must not be doing very much of that because I'm not getting very much of that. And if I want more of that, I know I just do more of this because this will give you this. So as we advance in devotional service, it becomes easier to understand Krishna and Krishna becomes more attractive. It's not that he's not attractive, but we become more susceptible to his attractive qualities. So they said to Krishna, they said, we are always servants of your servants, especially of Narada Muni. They were Narada Muni's disciples. So please let us leave for our home. And by the grace of Narada, we have been able to see you face to face. Then they asked a benediction, because this is a very important principle. Everyone should know this, but they should know it in its proper form. When you make a prayer to the Lord, you should ask for something. Conversely, if you want to ask for something, you should make a prayer first. And when you ask for something, you can ask for whatever you want. Dhruva Maharaj had a desire also. He wanted something that was impossible to obtain. He wanted everything. I want it all. Like a child says, I want the Hanuman, I want the moon, I want the sun, I want this, I want that. So Dhruva Maharaj, I want everything, the whole universe, I want it all to be mine. I want something bigger than the universe too. I want something bigger than Lord Brahma has, because he's the creator. I want something on top of that. I want that. So he came, but he had determination because he was a Kshatriya, so his desire was big, his strength was very mighty. So the Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, interestingly, they also asked for something. They asked, from now on, may our words describe your pastimes, may our ears hear your glories, and may our body be used to please you. Now, after they finished their very elaborate prayers and made their request, then Krishna told them he gave them his blessings. And he said to them, Narada has shown the greatest favor to you, who were mad after material opulence and who had thus become blind. He said, I knew all of this. I knew what Narada was doing. I knew your situation. Just imagine if we had that kind of faith. That Krishna knows me. He knows my situation. And he's arranging everything. And I should have confidence that if I place myself in his hands, everything will go according to my deepest desires. I will become happy by that. Instead of as present, as we're in the Kanista and the Madhyam platform of devotional service, we think, I would have to give up so many things. I don't know if I can do it. It would be such a great task. I'd have to give up my desire for this and my attachment to that. Let me take my time. Or let me change the subject and think about something else. But if we were blessed with this understanding that Krishna, he knows us very, very intimately, then it would be an awful lot easier. So then he says that when one is face to face with a sadhu, or one is fully determined and surrendered, there will no longer be any bondage. Then he told the boys, the young men, to return to their home, and in the future their desire would be fulfilled. So they left. They returned to the place of Kuvera, their father. But in the future their desire was fulfilled. And Srila Jiva Goswami, in his Gopal Champu, he describes that Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, just like Narada Muni actually, because Narada was a musician surrounded by beautiful girls. But he was very expert at his music. So he became Narada, who travels by playing the stringed instrument of his veena. So Nala Kuvera and Manigriva, they became Madhukanta and Snigdhakanta. They became two reciters of pastimes of the Lord in the Lord's Vrindavan pastimes. And Madhukanta would recite particularly the pastimes in Madhurya Ras. And Snigdhakanta would recite all the Lord's pastimes. And in the evening, when he would come back from playing in the cowherd fields with the cowherd boys, and there would be an assembly of Nanda Maharaj and Soda Devi, and all the residents of Vrindavan would come to see Krishna at Nandagram, Madhukanta and Snigdhakanta would play instruments and sing the glories of Krishna. So this was how Narada, he saw them, he could identify with them and their condition, and he made a plan. And because of his plan, they were actually liberated from their distress, which appeared to them to be great happiness. So I'll stop here if there are any questions. If not, we should continue with the program. Yes.
How does the Lord choose the recipient of His mercy? Like in this case,
how does He choose the recipient of His mercy? One time I was I asked that question of somebody. Why does it's causeless mercy? What attracts the causeless mercy of the Lord? And the person who I asked it to said, there has to be something simple in the heart. There is a word sorrow. What does sorrow mean? Do you know that word? Yeah. Simple. There's something in the heart that's not complicatedly crooked. You may be sinful, but you can't be duplicitous in that way. That means that you're there's something mischievous in the heart. So these boys and many of us, it was also said to me that we came to Krishna consciousness because we were sinful. Prabhupada could attract us. We were sinful, but we weren't devious, hypocritical. We weren't offenders of devotees because we didn't know any devotees. We were just sinful. And sinful people are all right. But the difficulty becomes, it becomes a little complex, right? Ajamil, he was simple. He was calling out to his son all the time. He wasn't thinking, oh, I'll do this and then I'll get that and that will get to this. And so sometimes in the Vedic culture, it's more complicated, more difficult to deal with giving the mercy of Krishna to people in the Vedic culture because they've got very complicated mechanisms of self-motivation in place that block the mercy. So on one side we could say, is this simplicity? The other side you could say that Srila Prabhupada would hold a meeting and anyone could come. Right? He wasn't saying, I'll take you can come, they can't come, and those ones over there, they can come, but not those ones. He was open to everyone. So one side we can say, what is it that attracts the Lord's mercy to a particular soul? The other side we can say, what is it that attracts the soul to the Lord's mercy? Right? Because it's a two-way thing. And what attracts us? That's something that is simply sometimes described as extreme good fortune. Prabhupada used an example like in India and some places in Canada and so forth. They would fell all the trees at the top of a hill and then they would push them all into the water and they'd come floating down the river. And he would say somehow one log may get stuck on the side. Who can say why that log got stuck on the side and the others just flowed right down and went and got sawed and cut up to pieces? But one log would get stuck, lodged on the side, and that log would have a different destiny than the others. So this is something to do with good fortune. It's Krishna's mercy. But our side is we have to become simple. We can be sinful. I don't mean I'm recommending you should all be sinful. But we may have been and we may see many sinful people that we try to offer Krishna's mercy to on behalf of Srila Prabhupada or Narada Muni. But they would take it more easily if they're simple. Ajamil was doing so many wrong things, but once he started chanting the name of Narayan, it was considered he was sinless. So as soon as we took up the chanting of Krishna in Krishna consciousness, we became sinless. We were still engaged in sinful activities, but Srila Prabhupada no longer took them seriously. He just emphasized the chanting. Unfortunately, a sinful person, when they come in the association of devotees, they may commit many offenses to the devotees in their ignorance, and then they may get put back outside for a while to rectify something. But there is something very mysterious in the way that Krishna works on the simple heart of a person who somehow or another is given an injection by... And practically, could you say also, Narada, that Nalaka Varimani Griva weren't simple, they weren't anything, they were just drunk. But Narada Muni was simple, and he saw them. That was the special mercy, and he wanted something for them. So his desire made this connection. That's so important to note, that Nalaka Varimani Griva and Krishna, there was nothing going on there. But Krishna was fulfilling Narada's desire, and Narada's desire was that they should get something. And so this is the way this mercy was obtained by them. Any other points?
Would you please explain why we need to ask for something when we make a prayer?
Because we have an opportunity. It's like a relationship. Right? We don't have a passive relationship with Krishna. We have an active relationship with Him. But we can ask for prayer. We can ask and pray for something that's just for us. Right? We can pray. For example, when I was a Gurukul teacher, we had little boys we were teaching, and Janmashtami would ask them all to make a card and teach them this, that you ask for something at the end. So some of them would ask for something devotional. Please let me serve you, or please let me become more, like to chant more, or something like that. And some of them would take the opportunity, because it was being given, I would like a bicycle, and also I would like... and they'd spontaneously give a long list of things they would like. You know. They gave a lot in their prayer, but they asked for a lot back. You know. So different individuals will ask differently. But it doesn't mean that we shouldn't ask. But it means that we should know what we should ask. Because it's a reciprocation. This is how we develop the sense of reciprocation. Otherwise we just stand... And if I'm not reciprocating by approaching, then I will not feel his reciprocation with me by his approach. I feel like there's no one there. Maybe God is somewhere, airy fairy up there maybe, or something. But very ethereal. And my life is really practical and dynamic, and I've got so many things I have to get done, and he's this ethereal kind of being. So most people think like that. But the process of Krishna consciousness is to convert that entirely. We can't imagine this now, but that our life, as we know it, our mind, our body, our family, our friends, will start to feel a little ethereal, like a dream. We've had lots and lots of dreams where we have families in the dream, we have friends in the dream, we have good and bad things happen in the dream, but then we wake up and, oh, that was a nice dream, but it's over. So this is what the process will do. It will take us to the point where Krishna is very tangible. And this world and all of its concerns and things, it's not that serious. It's not where it's at. It's there. And this is real. This is what we're trying to achieve. And I think, I say for myself, I think for all of us, we would wish more of that upon ourselves and others. That we could have that experience. We don't have that experience enough. So this is what we can ask for. Because there's a reciprocation taking place. If we ask for nothing, we'll get. So this is the thing. If a millionaire came in here and said, I'm giving away packets. I have a packet for every one of you here. How much would you like in your packet? You know, I've got an unlimited amount of money out here. I've got a big, you know, van full of it. How much do you want? You say, it's okay. Someone would come pushing by you and say, I'll take his as well. And I want this eagerness comes about when we ask for something, but we should ask for something that's relevant to us in our devotional world. Yes.
Mother, you were talking about simplicity. Now, is this simplicity something which can be cultivated? Because sometimes the mind doesn't permit us to be simple.
Yes. It can be cultivated. It's a bit of a strain in the beginning, because you have to first of all take in some philosophy. Philosophies, you know, most people, especially in the modern age, it's moving too fast, and people don't really want any philosophy because it alters. It's going to have a mind altering effect. It's going to slow me down. I know what I want, and this is going to make me go this way a bit. So I'll chant and I'll do my everything, but not too much of the, you know. This. And so we've seen this as a phenomenon with the children also as they grow up. They've been raised in Krishna consciousness, they know what it's about, they've heard it since their childhood, and they want to get on with their lives. So they're very courteous, and they'll come to the temple, and they'll do a little chanting sometimes, but you won't see them at the Bhagavatam classes. And in fact, they'll have a saying that if you start explaining something to them quite analytically, they'll say, oh, it's a Bhagavatam class. I had somebody do that to me recently, and I said, you know, this is a really bad habit, that whenever I tell you anything, you say, oh, it's a Bhagavatam class. What do you think a Bhagavatam class is? And they just remain silent. They don't want their thinking changed. They want to get on with it, you know. So the philosophy has to come, some philosophy has to come in. Because it slows you down and it gives you an option. There's this and there's this. And then against this you see some contrast between this and this, how I think and what the philosophy says. And that can be a little disheartening to begin with. Don't anyone worry if you feel that that's really disheartening and this is just not, you know, I'm not going to make any progress with this, it's too hard. No, that's there and that's there. But then, as we just heard Narada and Prabhupada and great saintly people, although we don't register quite like that, their business is to help us to come from this to this way of thinking. And they're not going to do it as harshly as we might want to do it. We might want to do it overnight. I just have to get this over and done because I'm getting so much suffering, I'm just going to fix this all up. But we can't do it like that. It's a gradual progression, change of emphasis. So this is done by our chanting, this is done by our sadhana. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, when he's editing in Brahma Samhita, he explains that one makes progress gradually, by a gradual process of theistic thought, proper conduct, and having the right aspiration. Gradually, gradually, gradually. But one, because it's slow, one has to be perseverant. So Srila Prabhupada knew no one would be perseverant. None of these young hippies were interested in perseverance. So he gave us the fast route. You can go back to Godhead in this life. Yes, you can do it. And so it was very exciting. Yes, how do I do it? You do this, you do this, you do this. And if you follow all those things, it's a fact. You can go back to Godhead in this life. But many people found later they started to slow down. This is, I can't keep up this pace anymore. Then if you're thinking now it's starting to get slower, then you have to take this gradual process very seriously. Don't lose the process. If it's going to be slower, then you have to be more perseverant, not less perseverant. But it will take more time. So gradually, 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 gradually. And as you change, you become more simple. Because you see things differently. Why aren't we simple? Because we've got two things going on. They're in conflict with each other. You know, I'm being a devotee, but I've got so many material desires. How am I going to... I've got to put this over there and that over there and it's like that. And don't want to see this and so on and so forth. But as those begin to dissolve... As the subtle body becomes gradually purified, we have less of them, we're less defensive, we become more relaxed with ourselves. We see our faults and shortcomings, they don't plunge us into total depression. They make us feel like sort of thoughtful, sad even, but not like, I'm hopeless. That will go away as we make further advancement, because as more of our assets are over here and less of our assets are over here. Now all our assets are over here and no assets over there, so we're being told put them all over there. No, they're here. So little by little, and this is the process of devotional service, to engage what we have in pleasing Krishna. And then gradually we want to please Krishna, and when we're told, you know, your son, your daughter, they belong to me, we think, how wonderful. Whereas before we thought, no, they're mine. you can't have any involvement in them, they're mine. I want them to do this and I want this and I want that. But now I'm changing and I'm seeing things differently. So this simplicity arises. All right, I think this is... Yes.
Sorry, do we have to...
Yeah, no.
When we want to serve Krishna, there's an element of surrender that entails that. But in the material world, surrender often means defeat.
Yes.
It means total submission. It means bankruptcy.
Yes.
So when you first enter devotional service, how do you start dealing with the kind of thoughts that run through your mind? Oh, you don't want to do this.
Yeah. Well, the first thing is that the word surrender is an English word that has been used to try to convey a Sanskrit word. It's a word that's not from the culture in which the concept has arisen. So Sharanagati means to go to where one's shelter is. To go to shelter. Like, as you say, I remember one time speaking to one devotee, and she was in a very, very, very difficult situation. She says, I feel like I'm like this, you know. and she was saying, this is what I feel like, this is what surrender means. Put your hands up, you've got a gun at your head, you know, you better surrender. So I was saying, but that's not actually what Krishna is doing to you right now. But because all the things that we love here, or we think we love and everything, they're perishables. But we have, by our nature, we have a longing for something eternal. So you think about it. If you're somebody who you like, do you want them to die? Do you want to see them hurt? Naturally, we don't. But that's going to happen. So then we think that that's God forcing me to somehow serve Him by taking away everything. But that's because we're functioning incorrectly in our intelligence. They're going to go anyway. That's the nature of this world. So when you become philosophical, you start looking at the nature of the world and seeing everyone here, 100% everybody dies. Nobody's ever beaten that record. Right? Someone may live a long life or a short life, but they're going to die. So when we apply the same intelligence that we're applying to our life in this world, our career, you know, getting everything in place for ourselves, when we take that same intensity of intelligence and we place it in the Shastra and we start to think more deeply about this, you'll hear that sadhus are telling you over and over again, wise men are telling you, this world is temporary. It's like a dream. Like I'm finding now, I'm older. When I was younger, I had a lot more energy and enthusiasm and passion to get things done. But now everything is starting to slow down. And so every now and again, I look at my life and I think, oh, I did this and I did that and I did so many things, but where are they now? Now what am I going to do? And today, oh, I have to get out of bed and go through the, oh dear. And then I start thinking about all the things, all my children, where are they now? What are they doing? I had such dreams for them when they were little, on and on and on. And then I think, oh, it just seems just like a dream. And then I think, well, of course it does. That's what they're telling you all the time. Oh yeah, right. There you are, proving it. But you're going to complain about it. But that's what they're saying. It's just like a dream. That's what Narada Muni was saying to Chitraketu. And Gira was saying to Chitraketu. Now you have sons and daughters. Now your suffering is beginning. Why? Because it's only going to last as long as a dream. So you have children, if they're grown up, you know. They're babies for a little while. Then they're young boys and girls. And then they keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And then they're gone. If you love babies, I had an auntie who loved babies and she had 12 of them. But they all had to grow up, so she had another one. Because nothing here is permanent. Nothing lasts in the way we like it. It's subject to change. So this is the material world. Get real about the material world. And then surrender, sharanagati, the actual world, word means go to where you have a shelter. So when you think like that, it's the only way you can remove the odious connotations on the word surrender. And another odious word, which I find I have to always remind myself of this is, again, this is the English language, is servant. Who wants to be a servant? Right? A servant of somebody. Of course, those who've ever seen a nice servant-master relationship will have a good feeling. But generally speaking, nobody would like to be a servant. They would much rather be independent and taking care of themselves. But again, Prabhupada said this, do not mistake this servant mood for what you see in this world. The servant of the king enjoys on an almost equal level with the king. So this is actually Krishna consciousness. Thank you.